Coming up on Behind the Headlines, Senator Mike Lee burnishes his Tea Party credentials, delivering a message against Obamacare and big government and for religious liberty. So how did his comments play with Utah conservatives? During his State of the State address, Governor Gary Herbert outlines new plans to reduce air pollution, partially expand Medicaid, give teachers a pay raise, and continue to defend Utah's Amendment 3. But will lawmakers play ball? Looks iffy based on House Speaker Becky Lockhart's comments calling him an inaction figure. Is campaign 2016 on already? And a worker at a Salt Lake City school takes lunches away from kids who haven't paid. So what do parents think of the bait and switch? The week's top stories, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines coming up after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, the State of the Union, the State of the State, the start of the legislative session, not to mention the governor's race, and of course, school lunch. Later on in the program, Tribune columnist Robert Kirby will also be with us. But first, joining me to talk about the top news stories of this week, Tribune education reporter Lisa Schenker. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning.
Government and politics editor Dan Harry. Dan, welcome.
Hi.
Editorial writer George Pyle. Hello.
Good morning.
And from Washington, our Washington correspondent Matt Canham, joining us by phone from his office in Washington. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
And you can join us as well. What do you think about Governor Herbert's plan to clean up the air? What's your reaction to Senator Lee's Tea Party response? And how do you think schools should handle lunch accounts that are in the negative? You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google Plus, or put them in the comments section on our website, sltrib.com, or of course, call us live. 801-355-TALK is our number. That's 801-355-8255. We're going to get to the story that everyone's talking about, school lunch, in a bit. But I want to start with the State of the Union. President Obama delivered his State of the Union address this week, urging a bipartisan approach to climate change, to a hike in the minimum wage, to a push for tighter gun control. Matt Canham, setting Senator Lee aside for a moment, how did the rest of Utah's delegation react to the president's speech?
Universally negative. This is clearly an election year, and the president made that case in the State of the Union. If you listen to what he said, as you pointed out, he was talking about trying to do these, he set it up in these broad bipartisan terms, but he always had the caveat, if Congress won't act, I will, which is a shot at the Republicans. This is a midterm election year where the balance of power in Congress, both in the House and Senate, is at stake. And the president is setting himself as running against Congress, against the Republicans. And so he not only called for action in Congress, he set up a bunch of executive orders, much smaller things that he can do just with his own pen, which would be a minimum wage increase for federal contractors, which would take place in 2015. He talked about taking his own action on climate change, which would be regulations that would manage existing power plants, something that has been in the works for years. It was a more combative tone than he's had in his previous four State of the Unions, and it's because of the political atmosphere that we're in.
Well, I mean, what does this mean for big topics that people really want action on, things like comprehensive immigration reform? I mean, can it get stuff done taking a strong, independent stance like that?
You highlighted the only issue that anyone in Washington thinks has a chance of actually passing this year, and that's immigration reform. That was the only major topic that the president didn't jab at Congress at. And yesterday, in an interview with Jake Tapper, the president said he would not veto a bill that did not offer a guaranteed path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. He said that if it had some sort of regular path to citizenship, which usually means getting a green card because you marry a citizen or you have an adult child who is a citizen, he might be able to accept that as long as it stopped deportation of the undocumented immigrants who are here and who have not violated the law and have paid taxes. So this is some middle ground, and Republicans in the House have promised to push a series of four bills on this topic. Now, whether they can get it done because their caucus is very split on this issue, that leaves a lot to be seen as the year goes on. But that is the one topic that might actually happen in Congress this year.
And has Utah's delegation weighed in on that?
Yes. You've started to see the position that the Republicans are taking is we'll do immigration reform, but no guaranteed path to citizenship, is the actual position of Representative Chris Stewart, who represents most of Salt Lake City. It is similar to the position of Representative Jason Chaffetz, though he has not been as explicit as Representative Stewart. And from the comments Representative Rob Bishop has made, you could see that he might be able to get behind something like that. Mm. Senator Orrin Hatch voted for the Senate bill, so he is likely to be a supporter if there is some sort of compromise. And that leaves Jim Matheson and Mike Lee. And I would assume from past comments that Mike Lee would be more hesitant to support it, and Jim Matheson, I think, would be a wait and see.
Speaking of Senator Lee, of course, he delivered the Tea Party response to the president's remarks. What did he say? Maybe you can just tick off a few of the highlights there.
Yeah, just to be really quickly, the minority party always gets to respond to the president after the State of the Union. Well, three Republicans decided to have their own responses. The main one was from Kathy McMorris Rogers, a representative from Washington. Mike Lee did the Tea Party response, sponsored by the Tea Party Express. And what he tried to accomplish was to say that Tea Party Republicans are not just a protest movement. Now they have an agenda to govern. And that agenda is things that they've been talking about from the start. He talked about getting rid of Obamacare. He talked about tax reform. He talked about prison reform, something he's worked with Democrats on. What he was trying to say is that the inequality we see in our government is because of our government, the way that they have the social programs for the poor, and it's the benefits they give the rich, and he wants to reform all of that.
Three responses from the opposition. What does that say about today's Republican Party?
It says that the Republican Party is not completely unified, and that's something we've known for a couple years. One of the most interesting battles in Washington is the fight between Tea Party Republicans on the right and more mainstream business-oriented Republicans in the middle, and that's where Kathy McMorris Rogers was representing. It's the more established Republicans. So she gave her response, Mike Lee gave his response, and then Rand Paul, who gave the Tea Party response last year, couldn't help himself. He had to give his own response this year as well. So it shows that that fight is going on and will probably go on through the primary elections we'll see early this year. And on the immigration note, what we're hearing is they're not going to push these bills until those primary elections are over, giving the chance that their members won't have to fight an inter-party battle if they end up supporting immigration reform.
Right. Dan Harry, how do you think Lee's comments play with Utah conservatives?
Well, I think Mike Lee has split the Utah electorate. You can see that in the polls. He got elected by being very far right of Bob Bennett, and he's stuck to that position. And turns out people don't like it as much as they thought they would when they elected him. So I think Senator Lee's got a problem, and I think you're seeing this new effort of his. It's been going on for maybe a couple of months now, where he's trying to position himself as someone who actually does have an agenda, can have a positive message, instead of just being the party of no, which really, that culminated in the government shutdown for 16 days. Nobody liked that.
Right.
Well, a few people like that, but they're a very small minority of people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he certainly took a political hit there. And does George, do you think that Lee's performance this week will sort of rehabilitate his reputation on the ground in Utah?
Well, the commentators more on the right, the bloggers and the people who write for the Washington Post and New York Times, have noted that Mike Lee was sort of the face of the government shutdown, or a face of the government shutdown. And they all thought that was poison for him, particularly for the party in general. And they've been noting, though, recently he's been making, in addition to this speech, he made a speech to, I think, the Heritage Foundation and some other groups, where he was still you know, in alignment with the Tea Party right, but he was making much more of an effort to reach out and say, well, there are places where we can agree, and the prison reform and the sentencing reform is something where he really has reached out to people way to his left, from Vermont and Illinois, who agree with him from a liberal libertarian view as opposed to a conservative libertarian view, that we have way too many people in prison. I mean, even if you don't care about those people, you care about how much it costs to keep them in prison. Minimum mandatory sentences that take the judge's power away from them and have minor drug offenders spending life sentences or effective life sentences in jail. There's a real hope that they're going to actually change that. I mean, the administration is behind it in theory. The Democrats are behind it in theory. There is a group of prosecutors who want to keep that tool, the threat of a minimum mandatory sentence, in order to help them in the plea bargaining process. Mm. But it really does look like this, along with immigration reform, might happen. Congressman Stewart was in to see the editorial board a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about a reform that led to not citizenship, but to legal residence. He said citizenship for people who have come here illegally is just a reward that we shouldn't offer. But at the same time, it's totally unreasonable to expect that we're going to round up all these people and deport them. It's bad economically. It's bad from a humanitarian standpoint. And so if they do work and they do otherwise obey the law, we shouldn't be threatening to deport them. We shouldn't be threatening to break up families. Citizenship, though, is a step he's not willing to take, and it does seem like there will be a lot on the Democratic side who will say, well, we wanted a pathway to citizenship. Legal residence is almost as good. It takes away the threat of mass deportation. It takes away the threat of breaking up families, and that way their children can become citizens, whether they came here as children or if they were born here. Of course, they are citizens, and we take away that fight.
Matt, how did the remarks go over with the National Tea Party Express? I mean, obviously, he reflects a lot of theirs, but what about those conciliatory notes, sort of reaching across the aisle when it comes to prison reform and other issues?
He's got a lot of high marks for tone, and that's what we're seeing. Is and what Dan pointed out is there's a shift in Mike Lee's tone. He's not shifted the way he votes, but he is trying to express a more positive outlook towards the Tea Party governing message. And on the national stage, he's been getting some kudos, particularly from the conservative press, that he has been an effective communicator of that. The Tea Party message in response to the State of the Union is seen by far fewer people than the normal Republican response, but it was still a fairly large audience. And it's a sign of how he is going to pursue policy this year. The prison reform is just made it through the Senate Judiciary Committee. The president didn't mention that in the State of the Union, which is a little interesting, and it might be an indicator that that's still going to take some work. There are a lot of Republicans who have a hard time with the idea of any sort of bill that makes it easier for people to get out of prison. That doesn't always work with an electorate. And so I think that one is something that he's been working on before this shift in tone and will continue to work on. I don't know if that's something that can happen in an election year, but it might happen in the next year.
Hmm. Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Matt Canham is with us. Also political editor Dan Harry, editorial writer George Pyle, education reporter Lisa Schenker, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or go online, sltrib.com. You can put your comments there. Also send them to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Lisa Schenker and Matt Canham, political editor Dan Harry, and editorial writer George Pyle. And if you've got something to say about the start of the legislative session or school lunch or anything else on your mind, you can send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put your comments at sltrib.com or, of course, call us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. 8255. The legislative session got underway this week. House Speaker Becky Lockhart opened for business on Monday and created quite a stir right off the bat, calling Governor Herbert an inaction figure. Those are fighting words, George.
Yes. I mean, usually this is kind of a make nice, welcome, we're all going to stand here and do the people's work kind of speech. And this really kind of took me aback, and I think a lot of other people, even though it's pretty well known that Speaker Lockhart is gearing up to run for governor in 2016. And she's not running for re-election to the House this year. She's putting on a staff. She's raising money. She's getting ready to run for governor. Her major hurdle in that is, of course, the sitting governor, Gary Herbert, and it's apparently in she thinks it's in her interest to try and undermine him and outflank him on the right, especially with the way we have of choosing nominees in this state with the convention system that lends itself to more extreme conclusions.
Does this signal that the session is going to be a rocky one, Dan?
Yeah, I think you can read it that way. You know, what people don't really notice is this is the second year in a row that Becky Lockhart has opened the session this way. She did it a year ago as well by saying if she were governor, she would veto a lot more bills, which was an interesting thing for a House Speaker to say. But yeah, it does get it off to a rocky start. And then Robert Gerke had a story that we published today about Becky unveiling a very ambitious education technology plan that would cost, it's estimated, between $200 and $300 million. Now, this is her proposal. It looks like it could be taken as a platform for running for governor. Whether that program will get through the legislature is a big question. Mm-hmm. The only possible way for something like that to happen, I think, is if you do some negotiating with the governor's office. And that's where these comments, far from our view, will take place, is when they are negotiating over the things that are very important to the governor on one side and the speaker on the other. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we won't be privy to those conversations.
Darn it. do we know how much Lockhart has in her campaign war chest?
I should know this because we had published a story right beforehand, but it's a lot of money. I mean, I think it's several hundred thousand dollars. And she held a fundraiser right before the session opened to restock that even more, which, of course, is interesting. And as George said, she's not running for re-election to the House.
Right. Well, the worst-kept secret, Becky Lockhart running for governor. Campaign 2016 is certainly off and running. And, George, it seems early. It seems way too early for us to be talking about this.
Well, I mean, we're talking about the 2000s. We're talking about the next presidential race. I mean, you know, is Hillary Clinton a shoe-in for the Democrats? Who's going to run for the is Chris Christie in or out? I mean, it's to the point where they have to do this, or they think they have to do this, because they have to raise money, they have to line up the consultants, they have to line up the county chairman all across the state or all across the country. They're scared to death that they'll miss somebody, that somebody who could have been their ally will commit to the other side before they get a chance to get to them. And they're just, it becomes the perpetual campaign, not just, you know, like a sitting president trying to keep his agenda before the country, but he's the next president. I mean, any president, you know, in his second term limited is sort of a lame duck. Obama, I think, runs the risk of being even more of a lame duck because everybody is already bored with him and they're on to, can Hillary beat Christie or is Christie already self-destructed? We've still got a government to run here, folks, both in Utah and in Washington, and we're bored with the show we're seeing now and we want to fast forward to the next one.
Assuming we still have a caucus system, how is Lockhart going to play at convention, Dan?
Well, you know, this is getting out there to speculate quite a ways, and we don't know if we'll still have a caucus system. We're going to find out this November, and if Becky Lockhart does indeed, as everyone seems to think is assured, I'm not quite sure it's that definite yet. There are certainly indications that that's true. But that's in 2016, and we may not have a caucus system by then. Mm. So I don't even know how much of a factor that's going to be. That is yet to be seen, and I think we'll hear more from the legislature on that issue about the caucuses before it's over, too.
Mm-hmm. Wednesday night, Governor Herbert delivered his State of the State address. He really made air quality the centerpiece, pushing cleaner gas standards and really tightening up restrictions on wood burning. Dan, how's this going to fly with lawmakers?
Well, you're starting to see a reaction where legislators are saying, I don't know if we want to be that heavy-handed. Now, what the governor's plan entails is mostly kind of like Barack Obama on the national scene, where he can do these things by executive order, by administrative action. And the legislature really does not like that at all. So you're starting to see some pushback where they're saying, wait a second, you can't do that on your own. You're going to have to come to us. We're going to have to approve that. And, you know, we're not really sure we want to do that. So you're starting to see questions about, you know, moving up the Tier 3 standards for cleaner gasoline, for cleaner vehicles, that it would cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It would be a lot of problems with logistics. Do we really want to start cracking down on people burning wood in their fireplaces from November to February? So while that was announced and it sounded like a very ambitious initiative during the State of the State, we're going to have to see how that ends up by the end of the session.
Hmm.
The other thing is a lot of what the governor said is not going to be accomplished right away. So in some sense, you can read that as, we're going to be doing these things and it sounds like we're taking swift action, but you're really talking, even if you pushed very hard on this, for probably, you know, 2-3 years away before you'd see any effect from these things.
Well, I don't think that the crowd of 4,000 or so folks that rallied last week at the Capitol is going to have that kind of patience, George. Is this the session where legislators are going to feel it, the public scrutiny of public policy, and want some movement now?
Well, history indicates that the legislature is totally immune to what the public wants. I mean, they put through the school vouchers. It was obvious the public didn't want that. They're resistant to moving on air quality. It's obvious the public does want movement on air quality. The governor talked about some things that he can do and some things that are going to happen anyway. I mean, federal standards on cleaner burning cars are coming no matter what Utah does. We get to count that as part of an effort toward cleaning up the air. The cleaner gasoline is something where the technology exists. We're making it here and shipping it to California because California requires it, and we don't. Not sure how hard that would be legally to get that enforced. One thing where the legislature would be a roadblock and is likely to be a roadblock is the law now specifically states, with some little loophole, that the state Department of Environmental Quality may not put down rules that are stricter than the EPA. This is the one place where the Utah legislature willingly defers to the wisdom of the federal government, even though they're the one-size-fits-all kinds of things that don't really help in this bowl that we live in. If the DAQ was free to write regulations that really limited industry, not just people's cars and their big campaign contributors, then something might change a little more quickly, or at least the state would get credit for trying.
Mm.
Now, that is something that we've been editorializing for a long time, and everybody and the people at the department have indicated they would welcome that authority, but they make it very clear that today they don't have it.
Mm. I just take issue with one thing that George said, and George and I agree on a lot of things, but not all. He said the legislature seems to be totally immune to the public push on this, and I don't think that's true at all. I mean, you've seen actually a great deal of movement, even from last year to this year.
The Clean Air Caucus.
Exactly. I mean, there are Republicans now standing out there talking about these clean air bills. You didn't see that a year ago. They got on a bus and talked about, you know, converting some buses to natural gas, and that was the extent of what they did. This year, it's different. And it's a Republican who's carrying the bill that would do away with this very restriction that George had talked about, that we couldn't pass stricter laws than the federal government. So, you know, there has been a change. Change doesn't all happen at once, but it is happening. And I think the legislators are hearing from their constituents because their constituents are darn mad about this dirty air.
Mm. We're also lucky that the Capitol is in Salt Lake City where the pollution is, and they'll have to come here, and it's not in Fillmore or someplace where this is
Well, that's another bill. They're going to move it back.
Okay,
to
well, that,
so
see, that's
that'll solve a lot of our clean air problem.
Well, it's like, you know, they didn't clean up the Thames until it became impossible to go to the Houses of Parliament without smelling the stench. I mean, it just if it affects the powerful, then you'll get something done.
Hmm. Matt Canham, you've got something to add on Becky Lockhart?
I was just going to say that what you're seeing from Becky is her planting a flag, and she's done this, as Dan pointed out, over the last couple of years, not only in the state but federally. She prodded all of our members of Congress on the immigration front as well. What you can take from that is that she has ambitions to go beyond her position, whether that is governor or not. And in that, when we have these big fights, you have to take that into consideration when you see the actions of the legislature. And one thing that should be very interesting to watch during this session is how the rest of the legislature responds to her and her ambitions. When, you know, Dan pointed out the education policy she wants to do, which is going to be very expensive. Do they rally around her, or do they push back? Mm-hmm. And on air quality, you're going to see the same thing. Does she draw a bright line between the governor or not? On issues like this, I do think the legislature is responsive. But as Dan pointed out, the fixes on air quality are not easy, will take years, and will take sustained attention and effort. And that's something we'll just have to see. It's you have big rallies of 6,000 people when there's bad air quality. But what happens in March and April when the air gets better? Is this a sustained attempt over years, or is this just a season of deep frustration that it goes away?
Right. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce here with Washington correspondent Matt Canham and our political and government editor Dan Harry, along with our editorial writer George Pyle. And we're taking your calls at 801-355-TALK, or you can put your comments at sltrib.com or tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk. We've been talking a lot of about the political fireworks that have happened during the first week of the session. To be honest, I mean, even though like 1,000 bills have been filed, not a lot of action going there quite yet. Dan, can you just briefly tell us what is on the docket? Give us a sense of some of the bills that might cause some debate.
Yeah, and I'll just preface it by saying, you know, it's been a little slow this first week because they've done it differently this year. They are not having standing committees where they're having public hearings and debate on actual bills yet. They're moving some on the floor, but these committee hearings now this week are totally devoted to the budget. And at this point, the budget is so, you know, you don't know what the end result's going to be. So there's not much press coverage. There's not a lot of debate and controversy going on. So that's why it seems fairly quiet so far this session. That will change before very long. You know, some of the things that are big, or we've been talking about, clean air is one of them. I think that in the wake of the John Swallow saga that dragged out all last year and ended with his resignation, although it hasn't ended, there's still a criminal investigation going on, that the legislators will want to do something about campaign finance reform and perhaps ethics reform. We're waiting for the House Investigative Committee to make its recommendations. You know, no one knows exactly what they're going to recommend. My guess is they're going to talk about, you know, small, carefully targeted steps. They're probably not going to impose campaign limits like the public wants. We polled the public. They want to see the legislature do that. They're probably going to debate raising taxes for roads and for transit. And in the end, they're probably not going to do that this session because it's an election year for most legislators. They will, you know, by the end of this, put together a $13 billion budget. I'm sure we'll have some legislation on clean air. Again, it will be, you know, something that will take effect in the future. We may have a very big debate about prison relocation this year. That's a very expensive and controversial project. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the the big issues coming down the pike.
All right. Stay tuned for legislative coverage. I want to bring in our Salt Lake Tribune education reporter, Lisa Schenker, to talk about the story that everybody's talking about, school lunch. Some students at a Salt Lake City school this week were given lunch, and then it was taken away. Lisa, fill us in. What are the details?
Essentially, the district heard that there were a large number of kids at this one school with outstanding balances on their lunch accounts. So someone from the district went over to the school to check it out. At some point, a decision was made to deal with the situation by taking lunches from the kids who had these outstanding balances.
And we're talking a couple dozen kids, right?
30 to 40.
Okay. Describe the school where this occurred. You went to elementary?
Yes, you went to elementary. This is a Salt Lake City school. It is in not a low-income neighborhood by any stretch. Fewer than 11% of the kids at the school even qualify for free and reduced price lunch. So this wasn't really a matter of kids not being able to afford lunch.
So was this like some rogue lunch workers, or is this district policy?
The district tells me that they're investigating who made this decision exactly at the school and how widespread this practice was throughout the district. We've been hearing different things. We know that it has been pretty standard in the district when kids are behind on their accounts to give them a piece of fruit and some milk instead of a full lunch. But as far as physically taking the lunches away and throwing them away, they're looking into how widespread that might have been.
And is this just an issue in the Salt Lake City School District?
Every district seems to deal with these issues a little differently. It seems like every district has people who aren't paid up on their lunches. We talked to Granite and Canyons and Jordan as well, and they seem to also give kids partial lunches at some point if they fall way, way behind on their payments, although none of those districts said they take lunch from kids and throw them away once they already have it in their hands.
This is getting a lot of reaction. I'll just read a couple snippets from our website, sltrib.com. No War Here writes, "This crap goes on in Utah schools and always has. It happened to my kids years ago and to my grandkids more recently. They tell you it's our policy. If you owe money, my grandkids are no longer in public school. Thank God." Let's see. This is from Skier Jim 7. "How about we name the person ultimately responsible for dumping the kids' lunches? That person humiliated and embarrassed little kids. A little embarrassment for that person should be in store." Lisa, do we know who was that ultimately responsible on the front lines? Who did this?
The district tells me that they're investigating. They're trying to figure out exactly who made the call. The school's cafeteria manager has been put on paid administrative leave during the investigation, and I've been told that more people could potentially be put on leave depending on what they find.
It looks like Granny K8. "I got links to this article from friends all over the country. Way to advertise Utah, family state that you are." Parents are not happy about this, and it is making national headlines. George, what do you make of it?
Well, I think most school districts do. They have public relations people, and what they need to do is, before you do anything, picture the headline in the paper. What's it going to look like? What's it going to sound like when David Letterman starts joking about it? What's it going to be like when the New York Times columnists start tweeting about it? What's it going to look like? And, you know, and it's going to get misinterpreted, and it's going to get stretched out, and it's going to make it sound, you know, 40 will become 400 will become 4,000 by the time it goes around the world. Part of what's interesting is a lot of people have volunteered to come forward and pay for these children's lunches, making the assumption that this is a class issue, that they're poor and that we're mistreating the poor. And there are a lot of people in the country who have suggested we do things like that, that kids who get free and reduced lunches should have to go through a separate line, you know, so that they basically to embarrass them. Nobody's doing that here. And it has nothing to do with poverty or class, although you do kind of wonder, is if this was done in a neighborhood where there were more poor children, would we have even heard of it? Mm. I mean, this was done in a neighborhood where we have upper middle class families who know how to write their legislator, who know how to call the newspaper, who know how to raise the stink. You have other neighborhoods where you have poorer people who maybe their English isn't so good, they're not familiar with the way things work. They may just think, well, that's the way they do things here, so they don't protest.
Mm. This from Ross G.A. Agree, the onus is on the parents to stay on top of this sort of thing. Disagree in that the action taken was misdirected and had an extremely negative effect on those who had zero control in the situation, the kids. Lisa, I understand two Utah lawmakers held a press conference at the school yesterday expressing outrage. What did they say?
Yes, Senators DeBacchus and Todd Weiler went to the school, and basically Weiler called for someone to be fired and called the whole incident bullying. DeBacchus talked a bit about how this should be a call to the larger issue of making sure children don't go hungry in schools. They said they may or may not work on some legislation dealing with similar issues, although they didn't provide any details.
Dan, is this a tempest in a teapot, or is this going to cause ripples throughout every district in the state?
I think the ripples it will cause is nobody else will do this again. And I also find it interesting that in the first day story that Lisa covered so well, and one of our other reporters, is it was put in the lap of a district official, and now the cafeteria manager is on leave. You know, and that kind of is the way life works, right? That the refuse flows downhill. So it'll be interesting to see if, you know, how high this goes up in the district. It's an interesting story, no doubt. As soon as we saw that it happened, it was gonna be all over the country. I mean, this is just like a made for internet and TV story, no doubt. In terms of will it really change anything, I don't think so. I mean, you still got to collect your school lunch fees, right? But I think there's a smart way to do it. This isn't it. And just don't stand in the way between a TV camera and Jim DeBacchus and Todd Weiler, because you will get injured.
Well, I mean, do you think there's any chance that legislation might come of this?
I hope not. You know, people talk about we have too many laws on the books. Well, this would be a perfect example.
Yeah, this sounds like it's a software glitch. I mean, the part of the problem was they weren't able to tell which children were behind until they had actually picked up their lunch and tried to check out. And so only when they were standing there with their lunch in their hand did the computer say, no, this child is behind. So they decided, okay, you can't have this, but for health reasons, you can't turn around and give it to somebody else. You have to throw it away. Well, that's really traumatic, and all it really does, everything in a school is an educational experience. The lesson of this, adults are stupid. My kids needed any more teaching in that area.
Well, I mean, the school district, Lisa, has said, you know, they make efforts to contact parents and let them know that the accounts are needing some money in there, that the accounts are delinquent. So, I mean, how far do they go before it reaches the point where a kid is given food and then it's taken away from them?
And that's part of what the school district says is obviously not working their notification system, because supposedly parents can go online and set up automatic notices when their accounts get low. I've been told that they tried calling these parents on Monday and Tuesday, but most of these parents were surprised at what happened, and a lot of them didn't know that they were behind or didn't realize they were as far behind. And the district says that they're not going to do this ever again, that they're not going to take kids' lunches out of their hands, although they may still not give kids who are behind on their balances lunches, giving them fruit and milk instead.
Mm-hmm. And other districts, I mean, I saw in your story that you touched base with a couple other districts. I mean, are they re-looking at their policies, or do they feel like their policies are pretty good?
The districts that we talked to seemed okay with their policies. It seemed like they try to recoup the money by contacting parents. They have grace periods. They spend a lot of effort trying to contact parents before they withhold a lunch and just give the kids fruit and milk mm-hmm. or leftovers.
Usually when we're talking about school lunch, we're talking about nutritional content. This is kind of an unusual story, Dan.
It is. It is unusual. And the other aspect that I find really entertaining is that a lot of these lunches are paid for by the Department of Alcohol Beverage Control and our liquor purchases.
What? So,
yeah. No, that's why that justifies the liquor system we have, is that a lot of the money goes to pay for school lunches. So get out there and drink more, folks, so these kids can have their lunches. And also, and then a lot of the comments, too, a lot of the cracks have been, you take a school lunch away from a kid, you're doing them a favor. I mean that's just our own memories of institutional food from our whole lives. We just assume that it's.
I have to imagine school lunches are better now than they used to be.
I would hope so. Yeah, I mean, I remember when they used to say there won't be a second lunch today because the French fry machine blew up.
We always had fish stick Friday.
Oh yeah, fish sticks on Friday. That's some cinnamon rolls that were pretty good.
Let's take a break.
I'm hungry.
We're speaking with Tribune editorial writer George Pyle, also with us education reporter Lisa Schenker, and political and government editor Dan Harry. We'll be right back after another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW.
Cinnamon rolls.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me in studio, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Lisa Schenker, editorial writer George Pyle, and political and government editor Dan Harry. And on the line with us from Washington, correspondent Matt Canham. And to wrap up the show, I want to hear from each of you your pick for the underplayed story of the week, one that you think may gain some traction over time. And don't say school lunch. George, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. This is maybe underplayed because it's just happening, but apparently the Utopia high-speed fiber optic system that has been such a albatross around the neck of West Valley City and various other cities, its director has resigned, mutual agreement, they say, and there is some possibility that the whole system may be sold to a private entity that hopefully knows how to run such a thing and get that off the shoulders of the taxpayers there, at least going forward. They still have the debt, maybe.
This is very recent. He just resigned yesterday,
Yeah,
just
resigned yesterday. It was a story in the Tribune online and in the paper this morning. And this is something that could be huge if they actually negotiate a way to get the taxpayers out from under this and operate the kind of system that it has always seemed to me we ought to have in one way or another. I mean, high-speed internet available to everybody. You know, there's going to be a day when that's going to be as common as running water, and you want to have that. And finding out a way to pay for it is proven to be tricky.
Okay, Utopia. Matt, what's your pick?
Marijuana, of course.
Of course.
Senator Orrin Hatch grilled Attorney General Eric Holder this week in the Senate Judiciary Committee about the issue and about potential spillover from Colorado, which recently legalized recreational use of marijuana.
Okay.
What the senator was worried about was the possibility of spillover across Utah's border and the fact that so far demand in Colorado has greatly exceeded the actual supply of marijuana. So he's worried that cartels might increase the number of grows they do on Utah's federal land, which has been a problem for years, and ship that to Colorado. The attorney general said that he will keep an eye on the situation and step in to police such increases in trafficking if it takes place. It's something the senator will be looking at, and I think we'll be looking at, too.
Ah, that sounds like a great story to watch for. Okay, marijuana, Utopia. Lisa, what's your pick?
My colleague Kristen Moulton has a story about the STEM Action Center, which was this project. It passed last legislative session, and there was a huge amount of money put toward it with the idea of improving math and science instruction in schools. And she followed up to see what's going on with that a year later. And I thought that was an important story because it's a huge amount of money, and it's important to see what happened to it and whether it is actually affecting classrooms.
How does it fit in with Speaker Lockhart's plan to sort of digitize schools and give teachers a little bit more? I mean, does the technology part of that fit in with Chris with this previous plan?
I think they're related. I think it's all part of the same wave going across the country right now, trying to get schools up to date on science, technology, engineering, math. It's become a real buzzword, STEM, and that's part of what I liked about my colleague's story. Is it really shows what does this mean to your child sitting in a classroom. It takes it down from this 10,000-foot political level.
That's a great story from Kristen Moulton. Dan Harry?
We had a little story before the session began about all the legislators, not just Becky Lockhart, raising all of this campaign cash in just the week before the session started. And I think that that is really kind of an interesting story because people talk about how, you know, how disgusted and appalled they are what happened with John Swallow and Mark Shurtleff and their fundraising efforts and taking money from donors who then wanted something from them. You know, that's what happens in these fundraisers. I'm not saying that people are selling their votes, but they're raising just incredible amounts of money for a legislative seat that doesn't pay that much. And they do it, they rush to do it all before this ban starts during the session. And it's kind of like a game now because you can't raise the money during the session, but man, you're going to spend those first few days before it opens raising all you can. Mm.
You mentioned John Swallow. Anything to update us on the investigations into his misbehavior?
You know, what I find interesting is we did a poll about whether people thought it was a good idea to do the House investigation. And actually, a plurality of people said, no, we shouldn't have spent the money doing that. But I think, you know, when that investigation was going on with the House committee, all of that information was coming out. It was public. We learned quite a bit about what had happened. And now that's shut down. And the criminal investigation goes on, which is all done very secretly, mm-hmm. you know, as it should be. I mean, these are prosecutors and FBI agents and state officials and county officials doing their investigation. But we don't hear much about it. But, you know, underneath the surface, I think there's a lot going on, and we haven't heard the end of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, my pick for the week is actually your story, Lisa, on preschool and sort of this shift in thinking about the difference that early childhood education can make. For those who haven't read the story, Lisa, can you just give it in a nutshell?
Sure. This year, this legislative session, there's at least three bills that will look at implementing early childhood education. And I think the tension a little bit is between should it be in the classroom, like traditional preschool, or should it be a software program that parents can use at home? There are advocates for both approaches and detractors.
Hmm. And the funding debate, will that intensify as the legislature sort of gets rolling?
Over preschool? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I mean, these programs are seeking a lot of money and they might go head to head because I don't know how many preschool programs lawmakers are going to want to pay for.
Mm. All right. Well, I guess that's all we've got time for. Matt Canham, thank you so much for the time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Lisa Shanker, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Dan Harry.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And George Pyle of the Salt Lake Tribune.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Thank you all very much for your time today. We're going to wrap up this hour with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, who has some fond memories sledding as a kid.
Yeah, sledding or tubing or whatever you call it was a huge pastime, not only for me, but for my daughters when I was bringing them up. And so I wrote about this hill that we used to sled down, and it was at the time, we believed that it was a hugely dangerous place.
Well, read a passage, if you would.
Okay.
Just describing at least the hill of your memory.
Right. This is the hill of my memory. The run started with a 90-degree drop between two boulders, followed immediately by a sharp bank around a junk car, then straight down a barely negotiable jump over a rocky creek. Provided that you missed the two trees on the other side, you skidded across the highway and through a dump site filled with abandoned appliances and rusting pipe, then a screaming plunge down the crumbling face of an old quarry. Failure to arrest your uncontrolled plummeting by grabbing the leg of a railroad trestle meant fetching up nearly fatally against a chicken coop wrapped in barbed wire. As if this wasn't bad enough, a pack of rabid neighborhood dogs would chase and bite your feet until such time as you and the sled parted company. No official measurements were ever taken, but it was conservatively estimated that Bernie's Run lost 4,000 feet of elevation in half a mile and sent a kid to the hospital every other day between October and April.
I love that. It really does capture sort of that thrill of the moment that you feel when you're a kid. But then again, is it exaggerated? What is it about kids' memories that isn't quite accurate?
I don't know. Probably because kids are more inclined to be adventurous. than adults. You know, by the time you get to be an adult, you realize that everything comes with a price, and you tend to be a little bit more careful and you have more responsibilities. As a kid, you're a 24-hour pirate and you just go for the adventure.
So what did Bernie's run really look like as an adult?
when I went back, I'll read how the column ended up. It said, I eagerly stopped by Bernie's run on a business trip a week ago. The death trap I remembered from 40 years ago is little more than a shallow depression in a small, nondescript field today. Someone must have dozed the hill, moved the highway, and cleaned up the junkyard. The railroad trestle had somehow shrunk to a footbridge. The only dog was a cocker spaniel on a leash. I put the new sled back in the rental car and left before the magic completely vanished.
Is that what it's like growing up?
Yeah, you realize that your memories aren't as thrilling as reality. That happened a lot, actually, because my family moved so much because we were in the military, so I could go in any direction of the compass and be going back home someplace, and which I've done a lot. And it's usually just a shabbier, less scary version than the one I remember.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, and you can read his columns at sltrib.com and hear him each week here on Behind the Headlines. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support by Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening.